I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
First dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? My dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Hello and welcome to Eureka, the show that gets under the skin of science in a good way as we invite a new expert every week to help us answer one of science's most interesting questions, as decided, of course, by us. I'm Rick Edwards.
And I'm Dr. Michael Brooks.
And today we're going to be talking about pain.
Right, we'll get straight into it.
How is your pain tolerance, do you think?
I think it's pretty good. Actually, I don't know what I base that on.
Yeah, nothing.
The fact that everybody else seems to moan. You know that thing when you're a kid where like you punch someone and then they say, that really hurt. And then you punch yourself the same amount and you say, see, it didn't hurt at all. Didn't hurt me. Mm. That is me.
It's like, right. Okay.
I think I've got, I don't understand why other people suffer so
genuinely,
much.
Genuinely, that is not much less scientific than the way people have been studying pain over the years. it's that hokey, just like made up scales and stuff.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, so I personally think I have a really high pain threshold, but I couldn't tell you why I think that.
I think you just sort of rate yourself, don't you?
Oh, kind of, yeah. Certainly, and physical stuff, yeah. Nails.
Most painful thing that's ever happened to you?
I mean, it's breaking a bone, probably.
Which one?
Breaking my leg. Well, I got my leg broken for me playing football. Somebody just slid in and snapped my tibia. And it was one of those things where I knew it was going to hurt more soon. You know, initially, it doesn't hurt so much.
Yeah.
But it was like, I heard that snap and I know it's...
snap's not a good sign.
It's not a good sign. Especially when I was at the corner flag and the goalkeeper said, oh, I heard that. But I did that thing
when
where
people are saying, come in.
I did that thing where you pretend it's not like what it is. And I thought, I've got to drive home before this swells up. And so literally drove home thinking, oh, maybe it's just a sprain. And
maybe your pain threshold is high.
And I accept that once I got to like it's only like 5 minute drive, got to the roundabout just before the turnoff for my road. And I just suddenly realized that I wasn't going to be able to press the brake pedal with my right foot.
Great.
So I had to do the rest of the driving with my left foot.
Hang on.
Because it just hurts so much.
You should be using your left foot to use the brake pedal anyway.
No.
You're driving a left-hand drive car.
No. No, it's your right foot on the accelerator and the brake.
I'm using my... I drive an automatic.
No.
So I don't, yeah, I'm nowhere near the clutch.
Well,
oh, the clutch. The good old days.
Anyway, so that at that point, the pain was more than I could bear. And I was literally, you know, changing the way I drove in order to bear it. But at the same time, I've had...
I wonder what the police would have said if they pulled you over. Erratic driving. I think I've probably told you before what the most painful thing that I've ever experienced was. Do you remember I had that sort of weird UTI sort of infection thing that was sort of lingering around and no one could figure out what it was for ages? And it was quite unpleasant. I was hospitalised on a number of occasions and I had every sort of possible test done until in the end they were like, we're just going to have a look in your bladder. And as soon as someone says that, you think to yourself...
Okay, which way are they going?
How are they getting in there?
Yeah.
Oh, dear. And there is only, there is only one way in. And it's, it's up the boy. So I went in and it's a situation that the phrase legs akimbo is designed for.
Right.
So you're just wearing hospital gown and then legs wide apart, everything on display, everything I think probably sort of quite... shriveled just with the
you're not everything's withdrawing from the
massively withdrawing and the doctor's there and there are two almost the best thing about it and also the worst thing about it was there was two trainee doctors there and the main doctor has to go out of the room for some reason to go and do something and so I'm just sat there with the two trainee doctors and one of them says loved you on T4. And I was like, okay. It doesn't feel like the time. I don't want to tell you about your bedside manner, but this fucking sucks. But then the main guy comes back in. He inserts the camera. Now, he's injected some sort of anaesthetic gel down there.
Right.
I think what's happened is it hasn't got quite far enough down.
Mm-hmm.
So when he's put it in, it gets to a point where suddenly it is the most searing pain. And I'd say it's like a factor of 10 worse than anything else I've ever felt. And I've like broken my wrist and stuff, like the classic things. And I was like screaming. So he had to take it out. I was like, I can't.
No.
But then he had to do it. So it went in three times before. And I was just like, it was like, when I eventually he got in there, he rooted around in my bladder or whatever it was, and then I left, and Emma was waiting outside in the waiting room, and she said when I came out, she's like, I've never seen anyone look more haunted or greyer. She's like, you look like a cadaver.
Wow.
You just look like a dead person, haunted, grey man, just staggering out. And I genuinely didn't want to talk about it either. She was like, how was it? I was like, nope. I'll tell you.
Did any of the doctors comment on the size of your testicles at all?
No, actually.
Oh.
Should have asked.
Is it abnormal? Abnormally small?
Well, I think they are. I mean, I think I know that they are abnormally small.
Okay.
But I mean, given the scenario, maybe it would have felt a bit like rubbing salt in
love
the
air. Love you on T4.
Yeah.
Not sure about the testicle size.
Why are those so small?
I was expecting more than that. If anyone's confused, that's a callback to our genetics episode.
Yeah, but also it's a sort of a callback to my actual life, which is I've got small testicles. So there we go. Whether it's breaking a bone, getting shampoo in your eyes, or being dumped by your first true love, there are some things in life that are pretty painful. But imagine any of these times by 100, or even a million. While experiences that are painful are comparatively rare, how do you think you react to a brutally painful event? Everyone has varying pain thresholds, so whether you soldier on at the gym after twisting your ankle on the treadmill, or you cry at the mere thought of the dentist, can there be a common ground for human feelings of pain? Can we all control our pain like Tibetan monks, or is there some excruciating instances where we can't help but shout to the rooftops? That's why this week we're asking, what is the worst pain in the world? So helping us out on what will be a painful quest today, I think, is Dr. Monty Lyman. So Monty is a medical doctor. He's an academic clinical research fellow at the University of Oxford and author of The Painful Truth. So he looks at the boundaries and meaning of pain, as well as how conventional understanding of it and treatments are, in fact, failing us.
Failing you, maybe.
I mean, if this entire episode is just going to be you sitting there going, well, it wouldn't hurt me, I think I'll probably quite enjoy it. So yeah, carry on.
I'm loving it. So we, obviously we are, I think, sort of obsessed by pain these days, but presumably, I mean, through human history, it's been like a defining thing.
Oh, totally. And I think it's interesting you say defining thing, because one of the problems throughout history has been actually defining what it is, what we mean by pain. It's fairly obvious that it's difficult to get a handle on, because the range of things that we describe as pain is so great. So, you know, you can go from anything from a headache to sort of heartache, so sort of emotional pain, to, you know, back in the day thinking, oh, this pain is a punishment for, you know, a lifetime of bad habits, or this is a gift from God to be endured, like all that kind of stuff. You know, and we've had huge misunderstandings, I think, around what pain is. I mean, as late as the late 19th century, I think in Glasgow at the sort of School of Cancer Medicine there, they honestly thought that cancer pain might be contagious.
Oh, right.
The idea that, you know, you could catch pain from someone else. And it's also very hard to put into words what pain is. So when you're trying to describe the pain, it's sort of, you're grubbing around a bit for the right terminology. And so there's been various attempts to provide that terminology. So there was a 1971, it's called the McGill Pain Questionnaire, and it basically just provides 102 different words to describe pain. And that's fine, but it requires a kind of an agreement and an understanding of what those words mean, which doesn't really exist. So it's quite thorny as a thing to get your...
So things like, oh, it's a stabbing pain, it's a constant pain, it's a dull pain.
Those are the kind of words that we do use, and I think we have some sort of consensus on what they... Yeah, on what they mean. So they're useful, but they're quite, I mean, obviously imprecise.
Yeah, yeah.
So getting a handle on, for example, what we were talking about, whether we feel pain differently, whether you have a higher pain threshold than me or greater pain tolerance than me, we will probably never know.
Because we have to do the same thing and then report like how bad it is, don't we?
Even then, I'm not sure you could be certain, because my... Like, I don't know that my scale is the same as yours. So even if I'm yelping and you're just sitting there, it might be that my yelp is just the same as you're sitting there. We're just reacting differently.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's fiddly.
But knowing that you're fiercely competitive, if we had a thing where we, like, I don't know, like drove a nail into our hands,
well, I'd be sitting here pretending it didn't hurt.
Yeah, exactly, of course.
I'd make sure I won, of course.
So that would be pain tolerance, wouldn't it?
In itself is quite interesting, because genuinely, your mind has such a big influence over this.
Yeah.
And so I think this is quite a bold claim, but medical science has, for years and years and years, I think, got this really wrong, because they've had this separate, and this doesn't just apply to pain, they've had this false separation between the mind and the body.
Right, yeah.
And that there is no such separation. They are effectively one and the same thing. Or the interplay is so complicated, it's meaningless to try and separate them. So I'm going to put the blame for that on Descartes, I think.
Oh, are you?
Yeah, I reckon, because I was like...
René.
Yeah, because before then, had anyone really sort of hammered the idea of mind and body being entirely separate? I don't know if they had.
No, and lots of cultures would have had them absolutely intertwined, wouldn't they?
Yeah, and then Descartes comes along and is like, well, no, they're totally... And I think people have really sort of bought into that.
What a prick.
Absolute. Not enough people say it, actually. People are all like, oh, Descartes. The guy's a prick. Yeah. but also, there's been, through history, some like awful examples of treatment and misuse of treatment, largely because of our misunderstanding, or almost exploiting our misunderstanding of what pain is. So we don't really have time to go into it, but have you either seen Dope Sick or read Empire of Pain?
No, but I've read reviews of Empire of Pain.
So Empire of Pain is this book by Patrick Radden Keefe, and it's all about the Sackler family, who a fabulously wealthy family who owned a company called Purdue Pharma, I think. And they made OxyContin. And you've probably heard of OxyContin because that, or Oxy, huge problems in America where you just have millions of people addicted to it.
And it's a painkiller.
It's a painkiller. It's an opioid painkiller. Yeah. And fundamentally, they knew how addictive it was and they just went ahead through various devious means of promoting it as widely as they possibly could.
They basically cashed in on its on how addictive it was, really.
Well, yeah, partly that and partly they just got it prescribed everywhere. They did an amazing... So one of the early Sacklers, who was not part of this kind of generation who are working on OxyContin, he sort of did the PR for Valium. He was the first... He's sort of credited with being the first person who came up with the kind of the marketing of drugs, really. Pharmaceutical drugs in America, which is obviously massive in America. We don't have it in the UK, thank fuck. But it's but yeah, they really, I mean, it's an incredible book. It's quite long, but it's really worth a read. But it's a horrible story, and it's all about pain and slightly how desperate people are to try and alleviate pain, and particularly chronic pain. So we've sort of got to a point now, though, where I think we're starting to challenge and change our conventional understanding and treatment of pain. So to kick off, I asked Monty to talk us through what our current definition of pain is.
So when I was at medical school, I always saw and was taught that sort of pain was a symptom of more interesting diseases. But actually, pain that lasts for a long period of time, a pain that lasts for longer than the tissue injury that initially happened, which is often known as chronic pain or persistent pain, is a disease in and of itself. In many ways, pain can become wired on the brain and it becomes essentially a neurological disease, and it affects huge proportions of our society, estimates of sort of between a fifth and a third of our society. It's the persistent pain is the greatest cause of work-related absence, but more importantly, it ruins lives, it ruins relationships, and it shortens lives. And it's been very poorly understood until recent years, and there's a lot of really exciting pain science that's happening at the moment.
There's quite a lot to get into here. I suppose it's worth trying to figure out what pain is, because the old idea is that pain is just a sort of product of injury or tissue damage.
Yeah, so you can't say, oh, there's a half inch cut, therefore you'll have that amount of pain, and you know, if it's deeper or you can't necessarily correlate it with
the degree of
damage.
Not at all. And you kind of, but back in the day, I think people definitely thought that you could. So the more severe the damage, the greater the pain. It kind of makes some intuitive sense, but that's not really how it works. And pain is actually much more malleable and therefore more manageable, I think, than we previously imagined. But pain perception is constructed from a load of sensory information and also context. So it's quite sort of multi-dimensional. Like, there's a lot feeding into what we perceive as pain.
So if you've got something like, like a paper cut, what you've got is nerves that are exposed or I'm trying to think what the sort of mechanism is.
Yeah, so
you've got signals going into the brain that basically say something's wrong.
Yes, right? Yeah, exactly. So if you think about actually the sort of the physical part of it, and this is a word that I've read a lot, know a lot, but suddenly realised I'd never heard out loud, so I don't know how you say it. So I'm going to guess it's nociception.
Nociception?
I don't know. I think it'd be nociception.
Isn't there an I after the C?
Don't think so. Anyway, so you've got these things that are called nociceptors. Let's assume that's how you pronounce it.
If you know, get in touch with the show.
And there's three different types, and they're triggered by, one will deal with thermal stuff, so hot, cold, whatever. One, mechanical, so like pressure, a cut, and one that's chemical. So an irritant or, you know, certain sort of chemical burns or whatever. And you describe all of these things as being kind of noxious stimuli. So they get triggered. There's no such thing as, so this is a common mistake, there's not such a thing as sort of pain nerves.
Okay.
Or pain receptors. That's not really what these are. But they travel up these two different types of fibres. So you've got the sort of the very quick ones that you call sort of first pain, the A delta fibres. And so that goes very quickly. And so that's like, I've just touched something hot. And then you have the sort of second pain go up these C fibres. And that tells you something, that something's still hurting or throbbing or whatever.
Yeah.
But all of that up to that point is not pain. So that's nociception. That is just the nervous system's response to the original damage or stimulus. And then pain only comes after that when the brain processes the signals.
Okay, that's interesting.
So yeah. Even though it feels like the pain is happening where you're feeling it,
yeah.
It's not. It's all happening in your brain. That doesn't mean it's not real, but it's all happening in your brain. And those incoming signals can be amplified, they can be attenuated, they can be sort of reappraised by the brain. So you can have very different experiences of the same stimulus. So you might well experience the same stimulus. In fact, you probably do differently to me, but yeah. Then equally, you could experience the same stimulus differently to yourself on another day.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
which is really weird.
And it's interesting to sort of think it has to be processed.
Yeah.
I was thinking, I probably bored you before about the time I got tased.
Yeah.
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 And I don't remember that as being painful. I remember thinking, I don't want to do that again.
Mm.
But it sort of effectively knocks out your central nervous system with a 50,000 volt jolt. And I only got half a second.
Mm.
And so I just collapsed on the floor. And
pussy.
There are people who are like hard enough to stand up and just say, come on, bring it on. But yeah. I'm not one of them.
No.
And, I didn't have, obviously I was the first person in the UK to be tased.
For God's sake.
So, but my point is, it only lasted half a second. I was sort of debilitated. But I don't think it was pain as such, because if it had carried on, maybe I would have experienced it as pain. But maybe that, I didn't almost have time for it to be a painful thing.
Yeah, it sounds like your brain hasn't really processed it as pain.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, I suppose the thing to take away is that pain is an individual and subjective experience that will depend not just on the stimulus, but on your mood, the level of attention you're giving it, the context. And if you just think about like something really simple, like picking up a pan that's got a really hot handle.
Yeah.
So there's lots of stuff going on there. First of all, you've got the pan is hot, so there's like thermal detection, and then you've got the location of that. So you're thinking about the location. That's my hand, and then you're thinking what's the intensity like of that? So your brain is sort of processing how painful is that effectively? And then you've got, have you engaged your attention on that? How much are you paying attention to that? Then you've got a sort of an emotional element where you're like, obviously, as soon as it happens, you immediately, I don't like that.
Yeah.
And then, so it's, again, as I said, it's multidimensional. And then imagine that you'd really burnt your hand badly picking up a pan before. So you've got some kind of expectation around it.
Yeah.
And so all of this is kind of feeding into.
So is that the sort of anticipation of possible pain? If I judge this wrong,
and then
if you do judge it wrong, it's even worse because you've sort of given it more attention.
So you can make an argument that your perception, our perception of everything as a human, is sort of about predicting stuff.
Yeah,
so always
yeah.
trying to be like slightly one step ahead.
Yeah.
Of what is. So in the classic example, actually, and it's a really interesting feeling because it's one of the few times that you'd be aware of this. You know when you misjudge a step? So when you just, so you're walking along and you go to step off the pavement, and you don't think about this consciously, but as you're stepping off the pavement, your brain is doing an anticipation where it's like, well, I know roughly how far we're going down here. And then if it's either lower or deeper. You kind of go, and it's because you've been surprised by the thing that you thought was going to happen not happening. Yeah. And I think that that is the case always, but there's not many, like the brain's pretty good at it.
Yeah.
Fundamentally.
Yeah, because we operate in quite familiar environments.
Yeah,
don't we?
Yeah.
So we kind of know how everything's going to work.
Yeah.
Except when it doesn't.
Yeah, yes, exactly. And I think what I've been talking about there is all really acute pain. So response to some form of damage.
Yeah.
But chronic pain is an entirely different thing. And chronic pain has only been recognized as its own thing really recently. So I think 2019... It's when it kind of...
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
which is mad. And chronic pain affects so many people. I mean, Monty just alluded to it. I think it's 1 in 5 Americans. It's 50 million people.
Wow.
And again, that tells you why there was sort of captive market for the Sacklers.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's lots of different estimates in the UK, but they think maybe 1 in 3 people over their lifetime will experience chronic pain. And chronic pain is just... It's just different. So... It's not a response to a stimulus or damage. Generally, it seems to start with a short-term injury.
Yeah.
But then when the damage has healed, the pain sensation continues. And it's like your brain has become wired to be oversensitive, overcautious, like it's hyper-alert. And it's an absolute nightmare because... For years and years, people would go in and say, "Look, I'm having this crippling pain. It's like destroying my life. I can't go to work." And doctors are then examining them and going, "But there's nothing wrong with you."
Yeah.
And this again is the issue of the misunderstanding of the sort of mind body divide.
So is this where doctors should be saying, "I can't find anything wrong with you, but obviously take you seriously and let's try and manage this experience that you're having."
That is exactly it. That's sort of the big thing in reading about all of this stuff. The main thing I took away is whatever someone says their experience of pain is, that is it.
Yeah.
And you have to just take that at face value. It doesn't matter whether you can find the sort of the root cause.
Yeah.
The pain is there and the pain is real for them. But looking for sort of simple physical fixes is basically not going to do it for chronic pain. So it's like there's really weird stuff like people with sort of chronic back pain, which is the classic, which I have.
Yeah.
When I've been MRI'd, there's nothing wrong with my back. Like there's no functional defects. It looks fine. And I remember the first time I got scanned, I was like, "Oh, that's good." And I was like, No,
it's not.
That's terrible. Yeah, that's much worse.
We're not going anywhere with this, are we?
Yeah. So you can look at young, healthy people, scan their backs and find sort of features in their back that you would go, "Oh, that might be uncomfortable," but they're absolutely fine and report no pain whatsoever.
Yeah.
So it's pretty complicated.
So chronic pain is like a brain malfunction or something where a signal gets sort of misread or amplified or something. I mean, is this...
But it persists is the thing, isn't it?
And it doesn't go away. Mm. So is that just, a kind of evolutionary shortcoming? It's like a price we have to pay. Somehow some of us have this sort of response that isn't helpful for survival. It's really sort of... I mean, people must have always had things like this.
Yeah,
and it
well,
probably was just seen as a curse or something like that.
So this is interesting. It might be that chronic pain is newer than that actually. It's fairly obvious. You can see how acute pain, so damage related pain, is good from an evolutionary point of view.
Yeah,
it's just a warning system.
Yeah.
And also as soon as you get it, like the body will start trying to, flood the air with its own painkillers, all that kind of stuff. You're like, that's working. I get it. And you see it across the entire animal kingdom, possibly even in plants as well, actually. Although you struggle to say they sort of experience pain in the same way. So it's adaptive and it's protective, but chronic pain, you just like it, that feels like it's serving no purpose at all. So I asked Monty.
Pain is vital for survival. Pain is a lifesaver. Pain is hugely adaptive. And I think generally we need to see pain as a protector, a bodyguard. Even if it's ruining our lives with long-term pain, pain is always trying to protect us. So yeah, from an evolutionary point of view, it is very adaptive. The trouble is with in terms of chronic pain, long-term pain, is that the environment we live in our modern society is not the environment we evolved into. And the brain is in many ways partly a threat detector, and it errs on the side of caution. It errs on the side of what are called false positives. So it would rather assume something is dangerous that actually isn't dangerous than assume something that actually is dangerous isn't. So actually it can be very easy over a period of time to have an acute damage to your body, but over time for your pain to become ramped up and wired in the brain, and then it can be really hard to get out of. So in a sense, actually pain is very adaptive for how our ancestors lived, with acute threats of saber-toothed tigers or exposure to flames and things like that. But actually in our modern society, and particularly as we're living longer and living in a society where you get a lot of psychological and social stressors like poverty and prejudice and oppression, all of these things are fuel for chronic pain. Anything that increases a sense of threat increases pain. So modern society is fuel for pain's bonfire, basically.
It's a good line, isn't it?
What a quote that is. Modern society is fuel for pain's bonfire. I mean, he's
great news.
He's basically like, I don't want to be alive right now. That's amazing to me that, like, this isn't just a constant through history. This is a new
thing. Don't think so.
That really surprises me.
But I suppose it does kind of make sense, because chronic pain, when you compare it to the pain that you had when you were running up a hill or, running away from an animal.
A stitch is quite bad, isn't
like
it?
Like the stuff, but that stuff, you're like, well, we've probably always felt that because we've always been doing it, but it's just completely, we just lead completely different lives now.
God.
Completely different stresses and strains.
So, I mean, talking about athletic pain, like, running up a hill or whatever else, or, when you get cramp, like massive sort of amounts of performance in modern sports stars, they talk about going through the pain barrier and sort of getting sort of pulling up with the pain and just running through it. I mean, is that a thing, or can you run through pain, and is that damaging you in some way?
So I think it is a thing, and it's not so much about running through the pain as it is improving your pain threshold and your pain tolerance. It's sort of no pain, no gain. The Rock.
Love The Rock.
You've got to bring The Rock in when you can.
Yeah.
So we'll get into the pain of elite athletes, phantom pain, which is probably the worst sort, and hypnotherapy.
Oh.
Don't giggle.
Oh, no.
Hypnotherapy is pain relief after this quick break.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
And we're back. So you were talking about athletes and whether they feel the same level of pain, I guess. Like,
you see them grimace
to...
and then they push through it and you know, and they come out the other side.
So this has been tested. So there was kind of anecdotal evidence, really. Well, you just look at it and you sort of go, well, I feel like they must be able to push through the pain barrier in a way that when I, you know, if I start getting a stitch, I'm just going to stop.
Yeah.
And I don't think that happens with that. I mean, in fairness, they're probably also not getting a stitch in the same way. It's probably a bit fitter. But when you look at elite level athletes, particularly the ones who are doing sort of sports with long duration and kind of like really physically intense activity. So I think that the group that they looked at were like cross-country skiers, which is hard work.
Yeah.
And they're training for hours. And those guys will have increased pain tolerance, increased heat pain threshold. They'll have a lower feeling of pain intensity with thermal stimulation.
Yeah.
So basically, they are just better equipped to deal with pain.
Has anybody ever done any sort of studies of their biochemistry? It's like,
I don't know, actually. Not that I've seen.
Me that if you're going to become an elite level athlete, you must have certain biochemical properties that mean that you can perform that much better and you know, do that much more.
My suspicion is that this is going to be, because pain is in the brain, this is going to be about rewiring the brain and neuroplasticity, not a physical characteristic. Yeah. I would think.
So when you're training, you just want it that much more and you push yourself that much harder.
Yeah.
And that results in, I guess, changed physical characteristics, but really it's about the brain.
Yeah. And you can actually see a difference between sort of endurance athletes and like football players. So you've just got to compare, these cross-country skiers with football players and then with, elite football players then just sort of people who are not like us, just sort of reasonably
almost
active.
Elite.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Getting there. Knocking on the door of elite.
Yeah, okay. And I'd like to put myself up against them.
Higher than good luck. Certainly not a cross-country skiing.
We're not doing that, obviously. That's not my sport.
No, I play football with it. But it looks like that the ability to tolerate pain, the more training hours that you do, the more tolerance you'll have. So cross-country skiers tend to train more hours than football players, interestingly.
Yeah.
And it's a different type of training because football players, you think about the type of activity, it's kind of anaerobic and aerobic. It's kind of a mix. Whereas the skiers are just aerobic.
They're mad fit, basically.
Yeah. So yeah, it does absolutely make a difference. But I haven't seen anything about the biochemistry, but I do think it will be entirely about the brain.
One time when I deliberately sort of experienced pain, when I was researching 13 things that don't make sense, a chapter on placebo, I went to this hospital in Milan where they do placebo research, and this woman hooked me up to this thing that gave me an electric shock. Mm-hmm. And she basically said, when I show you this green thing on the screen, you're going to get the shock. Mm-hmm. And when I show you the blue thing, you're not going to get the shock. And she then sort of mixed it all up so that my brain didn't know what was coming. And I started to anticipate a shock or not a shock. And I would rate my pain, whether I got the shock or whether I got a big shock or whatever else. Mm-hmm. And she was able to basically manipulate my brain using the display on the screen so that I didn't feel any shock, basically. She was giving me the same big electric shock. But because my mind was anticipating that I wouldn't get it, it just didn't happen for me. It was amazing to me that I fell for that.
I think we would all fall for it, is the truth of the matter.
Well, I like to think so.
Yeah. You're not just uniquely gullible. And Monty's actually got a very good story about when his mind, and this is without any outside influence, his mind sort of tricked him.
One of the worst pains that I've ever had, and one of the mildest experiences of pain that I've had, have been around the same time by the same object. So I was on my summer holidays from medical school with some friends on a beach in West Wales, and we'd gone to play beach cricket. So I was with a sporty bunch of people. I'm not very good at sport, I'm not very coordinated at all. So they made me a fielder right in the distance away from where everything was going on. But at one point I had to run and try and catch a ball. When I was running across the beach, I felt the smallest twinge in my right foot. My right foot lifted off the sand for a second, and then maybe 5-10 minutes later, and saw that there was a wire going into the base of my right foot, into the ball of my right foot. And as I looked at my foot, there was a very large fish hook that had become completely embedded in the ball of my foot, and it was, and sort of blood was oozing out of it. And that was when the pain started. So I say the pain was a sort of 6 out of 10 at that point. Then all my friends came over to look at it, and they're like, oh, that's amazing, that's really disgusting. And I was actually quite proud. I was like, you know, I can't play cricket, but I can step on a fish hook. And while that was happening, the pain went down to a 4 or a 3, while I was quite proud of it and showing it off. And then once my friends had lost interest, and I sort of went and sat on the edge of the harbour wall looking at this fish hook stuck in my foot and deciding whether I should go to A&E, the pain went up to a 7 or an 8. And when I sort of imagined the motions of yanking it out or twisting it out of my foot, the pain went up to a 9. I went up to a 10, more than a 10. And there's a second half to the story in that I took the fish hook out and it healed. And about a year later, I was in a similar area of West Wales. I went for a run along one of the beaches with my parents' dogs, and about 5 minutes into the run, I felt just the worst searing pain shoot up the ball of my right foot, and looked at the ball of my right foot, and there was the tiniest scratch from probably a pebble or something like that. And when I saw it, the pain went away. But what happened is that before I consciously had any feeling of pain or anything like that, my brain was predicting what that signal was. So a danger signal, a small danger signal, was sent from my foot to my brain.
It is all about expectation.
Yeah.
Like, to the extent that the placebo effect... Because, you know, the thing about the placebo effect is I think it gets a really bad press because people are like, with somehow sort of deception or trickery, or like it feels like it's not real or something. Like it doesn't feel like people look at it positively.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
But
yeah,
Actually, it's fantastic, and it should just be renamed like the expectation effect.
Yeah.
And you should just acknowledge the power of it and enhance it.
Because you can use it medically in a very positive way.
Totally. And we'll come on to talk about this, and you can do it with extraordinary results, in fact. But I'm going to tell you a couple of stories similar to Monty's, I guess, but for like famous stories that you might actually be aware of, where the body has just got something totally wrong, but in a very understandable way. It's just predicted something. Mm. So in 1995, there's a sort of famous case of a builder who has jumped down on his site. He's wearing his work boots, but he's jumped onto a 6-inch nail. The nail has gone straight through his boot.
Yeah.
He's just like, fuck! Whisked off to hospital, excruciating pain. They give him some painkillers. It settles down. He's like, oh, God, God, God. They get the boot off, and they're like, oh, the nail has missed. It's gone between his toes. It hasn't pierced his foot. But the brain, not unreasonably, has pieced together all of that sensory information. It's gone, I've just jumped onto a nail. That's bad. I can see that the nail has gone through. I can see that it's gone through the boot.
Yeah.
And so that pain, that you could look back on and say, well, that wasn't real. But it was just as real as any other pain. It just, with all of the available evidence, that was a reasonable conclusion for the brain to come to. So humiliating for the guy.
Yeah, I was going to say, so he's basically assumed that it's gone through his foot and you can't feel it.
Well, yeah, but not consciously. That's the thing. He hasn't sort of, I mean, subsequently, yes, consciously, you'd look at it and go, well, yeah, absolutely, my foot hurts. But the brain's immediate assessment is, well, that's really bad.
And actually, nothing happened to him. He needs to grow a pair.
And then whack a nail through the pair. But then there's another I think sort of worse story where, and this is from 2007, again featuring a nail, this time a 4-inch nail.
Okay.
This made me feel honestly sick. So again, a builder, he's using a nail gun. Somehow, like something happens and the nail gun fires and it sort of fires towards his towards his face. He's like, whoa! But as far as he can sort of tell, everything's fine. He's like, I think, oh no, it's okay. I've just got a slightly, he had a bit of like mild toothache and a bit of a bruise by his jaw.
Yeah.
But he carried on essentially fine for 6 days.
Right, I know where this is going.
Until eventually, I actually can't remember what the trigger was, but he was like, no, maybe something is going on here. He went and got an x-ray. The nail had entered his head and pierced his cerebral cortex.
Holy shit.
So this is a situation where the brain has looked at the available evidence and gone, I think we're all right.
We got
actually
away with it.
I think we've got away with it. And so at no pain. Whereas if he'd known that had gone in,
yeah,
I mean, you'd be
freaking out.
You'd be freaking out like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah.
And in agony.
Yeah.
And he was basically, like I say, basically fine.
So you just go back to work the next day.
Yeah. Yeah, it was 6 days. 6 days with a nail like embedded in you. In your head. It's
presumably they took it out. They didn't say, do you know what? If you've done 6 days, you're probably fine.
Yeah. Do you want it as a souvenir?
Yeah. Just don't put any magnets close to your face.
But that's the sort of, that's the power of the mind in creating what it believes to be the sort of the situation.
Yeah.
And it is worth saying as well those sound like sort of fails, but actually you'd much rather that. You'd much rather the brain was working very hard to make these predictions than not. And for example, if you don't feel pain, so there's a really rare condition called congenital analgesia,
yeah,
where you just don't feel pain. And there's a case of a boy in Pakistan called Naveed who was sort of 13, and he didn't feel any pain, and he used to sort of like, he'd walk on hot coals and everyone would love it, and he'd sort of stab himself in the hand and everyone would love it, and he just wouldn't feel anything. And then one day he jumped off I think the roof of his house to sort of impress his friends, like quite high, fell, dusted himself off, picked himself up, wandered off fine, and then subsequently passed out, and he'd got such a bad bleed on his brain he died. But I had no idea.
Right. Yeah.
So pain is a really important protective mechanism that you absolutely need it. You just don't need chronic pain. I mean, you really don't need chronic pain.
No.
You don't need chronic pain at all. And when it comes to chronic pain, it's fairly clear that taking a painkiller or an opioid, so it doesn't really matter how strong the painkiller is, that's not going to rewire the brain, which is effectively what you,
because the painkillers are acting on certain sort of electrical signals or chemical pathways or something, aren't they? They're not acting on the thing that's inside the brain effectively.
No, and it can, in fairness, that they can have some effect, but they're never gonna get rid of it. Like they couldn't get rid of it. And the aim really has got to be to try and get rid of the chronic pain, not just think, well, I mean, it would be possible. Although actually it doesn't even have, it sort of works for about 1 in 3 chronic pain sufferers, I think, to just dose yourself up with painkillers, just numb everything. But that in itself is a pretty miserable existence anyway.
Yeah.
And it's clearly not the right sort of route to take. So I asked Monty to share actually his own, he's got a personal journey with alternative pain relief methods.
So I had never heard about hypnotherapy when I was at medical school. I was very sceptical about it. The only hypnosis I'd ever come across was either comic or sinister on TV or in movies. But I actually went to a hypnotherapist to interview him for my book, and he asked whether I experienced any long-term pain. And I said, yes, I've suffered with IBS for as long as I can remember, and sometimes most of the time it's embarrassing or uncomfortable, but sometimes I can't even get out of bed. And he said, okay, but why don't we do a hypnotherapy session, and then I'll give you the recording and you can practice yourself. So we did a session, and it essentially felt like a deep sense of relaxation, and he was just sort of focusing my attention to different parts of my body. And he told me to imagine my sort of bowels as rocky rapids, and then to visualize them as the languid Thames with punts gently floating down it, and just to continually reimagine that. So we did that, sent me home with the recording. I did it for sort of 15 minutes every morning for a couple of weeks, didn't really do anything. I was still quite skeptical. But then after about a couple of months, it started to make a difference, and within sort of 3-4 months, my IBS was completely cured, and it basically hasn't come back since. And I'm not saying that hypnotherapy is the only cure for every type of long-term pain, but it's the stuff that's behind it. It's the idea that it was decoupling the pain that I was experiencing with fear, with threat, with fear that I was damaged in some way. And the kind of the powerful visualization as well was a way of helping basically winning over my brain, using the power of visualizing repeatedly, actually reduced the sort of the quote unquote pain areas in my brain.
So what I think this comes down to is trying to make, when it comes to chronic pain, trying to make your brain feel safe in your body, which sort of sounds mad.
Yeah.
But I think that is...
No,
that,
but I get that. It's like your brain is just like freaking the fuck out, basically.
Yeah, and you just need to reassure it. You need to try and reduce the threat cues that it's perceiving. Yeah. And so, yeah, hypnotherapy, physiotherapy, exercise, all sorts of things do seem to have
Meditation as well.
Yeah. Will have genuine positive effects on chronic pain. And one of the things that is interesting is if you can shift the brain's attention to visual tasks, that's really good, because visual tasks take up a lot of sort of mental capacity.
Yeah.
And so you sort of like swamp the brain with something else to think about, and it stops focusing on the pain.
Yeah.
And so virtual reality is amazing for this. And so I think this will be it for chronic pain.
Wow.
I think in the next sort of 5 years or so, virtual reality will be one of the main ways out of it. So there's some excellent studies going on. So in the University of Washington, they've been getting severe burn patients. And when you have to dress and undress their wounds, that is absolutely agonizing. And what they've been doing is they've been getting some to wear VR headsets, and they play a game called Snow World, where you're just pelting snowballs at like penguins and mammoths and stuff.
Right.
Sounds quite fun. Yeah. And it's really involving, it's really engaging, and it's really distracting. And when you talk to them, the patients, they're like, the pain is halved.
Wow.
Halved by that. So they're asking for less painkillers.
Yeah.
Immediately.
Yeah.
And when you do MRI scans of their of the sort of pain related activity, and there was an idea probably 20 years ago that we'd be able to create these perfect maps of pain in the brain, and I don't think we're quite there, but we can see when certain areas light up, and we know that they relate to pain, and you can see that activity is much less when you put them in these virtual reality settings. And there's another one in Strasbourg called Hypno VR, and there you get some post-surgery kids, and you just put them in sort of peaceful locations like woodlands or beaches, and you have a nice sort of soothing, sort of calm voice. And again, the kids require about half of the normal amount of morphine.
Wow.
That they would have done. So it's really it's really impressive.
I wonder if that feels like the way forward. Yeah,
I mean,
I wonder if that'll trickle down to like childbirth and things like that.
Potentially.
Like you just give birth with a VR headset.
Except.
But people like to be present in that moment,
don't they? And also you need to be able to focus on pushing, don't you? So I wonder, because our brain is amazing, but it can only really sort of cope with one reality at a time.
Yeah.
And so if you present it with a different reality, which is what the virtual reality is doing, obviously,
yeah,
that the actual reality sort of falls by the wayside, and you kind of need some attention on that actual reality, don't you? So I don't know.
So somebody needs to invent a VR game where you're actually pushing out a child.
But it doesn't hurt.
It doesn't hurt.
It weirdly doesn't hurt. Yeah. Yeah, maybe. Don't know. But the sort of belief, what you were saying about your placebo experiment, like belief is so strong. So what you think is happening, I mean, you know, that exactly like the guy who thought he had a nail through his foot, and exactly like the guy who didn't think he had a nail in his head. Like, yeah, what you believe is sort of all important. And there is an absolutely superb experiment. You know, we occasionally, I think we've had a few in the last few episodes, actually, just great experimental design. You like, I like it. So they got volunteers and then they were burning them on the leg.
Oh, right.
And asked to rate the pain on a pain scale, sort of 0 to 100. And again, like, you know, we don't need to go in again to the fact that pain scales are tricky and you don't know whether your 70 is the same as my 70, whatever. Yeah. You've got everyone to say that they were roughly at 70. And then they're in an MRI scanner as well, so you can see what's going on in their brain. And they're also on an IV drip for an opioid painkiller, so strong painkiller. So first of all, they're just sitting there. You don't tell them that anything's happening, but you've started giving them the drug, and you ask them what their pain level is. Like.
Yeah.
And for everyone, it drops. So, and I think actually everyone sort of starts at an average of 66, and it drops down to about 55. So that is the drug just working without any sort of expectation around it. You don't think it's in there, but it's happening. The key thing is the whole way through this experiment, you keep the same level of pain relief.
Of course you do.
Nothing changes. Then next you say, we started giving you the drug now. How do you feel? And they're like, oh yeah. It's gone down from 55 now to 39.
Yeah.
It's at the same level.
Yeah.
So that's
idiots.
Yeah, well, kind of, but you'd be that idiot as well. And then you say, it's stopped. We've turned the drug off, unfortunately. It's still the same level. And you're also told that something, your pain might increase here. And it, when everyone self-reported, went up from 39 to 64, which is effectively back to where you started, the same as no pain relief.
Yeah.
So you get rid of the effect of the drug. So you can sort of do anything you like there. That's both placebo and nocebo.
Right, yeah.
And both really powerful.
We're so easily manipulated, aren't
we? Yeah, but that's, isn't that encouraging though? That if you can do that, then you should be able to trick the mind into not giving you chronic pain.
Yeah. I mean, when I did my thing, I was really surprised that, because I knew I was researching the placebo effect.
Mm.
You know, I literally knew what must be going on, but I had no power over it at all.
No.
So it seems like, you know, it doesn't even matter if you say to people, look, it's just a placebo, but we can manage this.
They've done experiments with that where they literally say, we're going to give you a placebo for this thing and it will still have an effect.
Yeah.
According to the cues that they give them.
It's mad, isn't it?
It's really mad. But it does mean that poor expectation of the treatment you're about to get can override a potent pain reliever, which is really worth bearing in mind for doctors in terms of what they say to people about what is about to happen, I think. Whereas if you have a positive expectation, it can sort of double the effect of the same drug.
Yeah.
So you can go either way according to how you sort of prep someone.
So when I was a kid and punching my brother, what I should have said was, first of all, this level of punching won't hurt that much. I can do it to myself and it doesn't hurt.
Uh-huh.
And then when I punch him, he'd have said, oh yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Instead, I punched him first and then punched myself and said, no, it doesn't
hurt.
Yeah,
you're doing it in the wrong order.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. I do also think, I don't know if this is right, I think it is, that given that, it's quite interesting for clinical trials, because if you don't manage the expectation of the subjects, then a negative expectation might end up just masking true efficacy. Do you see what I mean? You could be testing a drug to try and work out whether it's effective, but if people don't think it's going to, then it might not, but that's not because the drug hasn't worked.
And I think I've read elsewhere that drug companies want to be able to like get people out of trials if they're particularly suggestible.
Yeah,
because the placebo then is almost as good as their drug, and that's really problematic.
Yeah, yeah. Or nocebo is making their good drug look shit.
Yeah, yeah. So you have to, yeah. So they want to be able to control for that.
Mm.
But I like the idea of, you know, being able to take control of this, design ways in which you can do pain intervention, but without, you know, necessarily intoxicating or addicting people, yeah, you know, in the same way.
Well, that's the thing. If you think about like using VR, there's not really any adverse side effects. You might get a bit of motion sickness, maybe, yeah, but that's about it.
Yeah.
Whereas opioids, addiction, and then, oh dear, death.
Yeah.
Not great.
Not ideal.
So I realise we haven't really answered the question, what's the worst pain in the world?
Because I would argue that we have. It's that chronic pain that doesn't have an actual... Yeah, it's not a nail through the foot or nail through the jaw.
No. Yeah, I think... you're right. It's chronic pain... But then you also, I think, have to acknowledge that you can't really compare one person's chronic pain to another person's chronic pain or one person's acute pain to another. So it's pretty much just whatever the worst pain for you is.
Right, yeah, yeah. I was going to say, like, when we started, I thought we were going to talk about, like, you know, insect bites or, like, snake bites.
Don't think it... Yeah, it only makes sense for an individual. Like, you could come up with your own.
Yeah.
Scale if you wanted to, but I don't think that scale would translate to the wider population necessarily.
Yeah.
Although when I was reading, a lot of people did say kidney stones.
Oh, really?
Yeah, apparently kidney stones is absolutely horrific.
My father had those.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. He moaned a lot.
And what I did, I mean, you know, bringing it back to my fantastic story about getting my bladder examined, the thing that apparently is most painful about kidney stones is when the stone passes out of the kidney, and that sort of scraping down, and that's effectively what the camera is doing.
Yeah, lovely.
So I was like, I'll buy that.
So you might have had the worst pain experience, you know.
Well,
in terms of physical pain.
I'm just saying. Let's get Monty's view on the worst pain in the world.
The worst pain in the world is the worst pain that you experience, and that I promise that isn't a cop out. Pain is completely subjective, and there is no proper way of measuring pain on scans or whatever outside of asking people and understanding where they're coming from. So I think the key message is your pain is completely real, and we can't necessarily compare different types of pain. Well, the other answer that I get from people when I ask them is that stepping on Lego is the worst kind of pain.
Yeah, so he's agreeing with us, and he's giving us quite a fun answer.
Yeah.
Well done, Monty.
Good work, Monty. I like that.
Yeah. I actually don't think I've ever stepped on any Lego.
Well, it's because you don't have any kids, isn't it?
But I was a child once, presumably, and I had
Lego.
It's
not the same. When you're an adult, especially when you're like let me tell you from experience.
Is it the ignominy?
No, it's because you're a new father. You've been eating too much. You've been comfort eating.
Yeah.
You're fat, you're heavy, and you're not very coordinated because you're basically lacking in sleep.
Mm.
And then you step on, you know, you basically walk into a room.
You've not had a baby recently, have you?
Still shedding the baby weight. And it just goes right through your foot.
I suspect there's a kind of added fury around the fact that your house is now an absolute tip. And you're just like, oh, for... Eureka is a Stack production presented by Dr. Michael Brooks and Rick Edwards. The production team is Temi Adebayo, Katie Baxter, Luke Moore and Charlie Morgan. Sound design by Katie Baxter. Special thanks to today's expert, Dr. Monty Lyman. Please subscribe and rate wherever you listen to your podcast. It does make a massive difference. We also really love hearing from you guys. So if you have any burning questions you want us to answer, drop us an email at eureka@stack.london, or you can find us, as always, on Twitter at EurekaPod. Thanks.
Eureka is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over 3 glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.